Dennis Reid was your average family man. He had a wife, two kids, house in the suburbs, and a steady job. But he held a dark secret. His dark secret is he would stalk people, and then he would bind, torture, and kill. This is the story of the BTK Strangler. Welcome to Enter the Dark. Hello and welcome to Enter the Dark. I am Jan from Film Daddy. With me as always is Les from Tales from the Hangman. Les!
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, sir?
I'm very good.
I don't know my American holidays very well, but I'm gonna say Happy Thanksgiving.
It is Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving's coming up. I think it's on the 24th. Is it this Sunday it's coming up?
Oh, this won't be out by then.
Yeah, anyway, I think it's the 24th.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. I hope it was good and you watched Survivor Series because that's the only reason I know about Thanksgiving. That and the subjugation of an entire nation of people. But I'm British, I can say it. We own it. Welcome to today's show. Yeah, it's going to be a good one. We're doing the BTK Killer. Oh, he's a good one.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this one. I'm quivering with anticipation. Patient.
That was fucking terrible.
I'm no Frankenfurter.
No, you know, you definitely aren't. But yes, so quickly, because I really want to get into this one. Remember, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/enterthedark or one word. We do have some people who do that. And we've got two people who we have to say hello to because they've paid enough money. We have got Mia Prescott, hello, who is on our Edward Kemper tier. And Whoa. Also, on our Jeffrey Dahmer tier, we have Philip Sigrist. I've just butchered your name, I'm sorry. And he's from Switzerland.
Oh, Switzerland.
Yeah, and he's told us a case that we're going to cover, but I'm going to keep that a secret.
Oh, is that one for the future?
Yeah, it's for the future. You sounded so camp then.
Oh, matron, is that one for the future?
Oh, it's a good job I didn't do a Swiss accent.
Yeah, but guys, thank you.
Yeah, much appreciated.
It is. Like we always say, we do this for fun, and it's really nice that you guys can support us, and, you know, we get extra microphones and stuff like that for it. So, thanks. We've also got our T-shirts, too. We've now got ones with serial killers on the front. Some people have called it sick. Others have called it the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, someone got really salty about it, didn't they?
Yeah, and it was just like, you know, fucking sub off Debbie Downer. But if you do want to buy one, the link is up. So yeah, get one of our T-shirts and help us support us that way. But first of all, let's get into this. First of all, it's not first of all because it's like the fourth thing we said. Let's just get into it because I don't know what the fuck I'm on about.
So BKY.
BTK.
BTK. What the fuck is BKY? That sounds like it's
You're
something.
Thinking of CKY, the band, Camp Kill Yourself. Very big with Bam Margera because his brother was the drummer.
Oh, yeah. I remember all the fucking T-shirts back in the day. Yeah.
CKY. It was shit. Anyway, Dennis Lynn Rader. Now, no offence, but if you give your son the name Lynn, you're going to turn him into a fucking killer.
Also, Rader. Rader as a surname. I raid Lynn's!
Dennis Lynn Rader! This is going to go on for a while, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so Dennis Lynn Rader was born in a quiet corner of Kansas, close to where Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri all meet. That was on March the 9th, 1945.
Oh, okay.
So he was the first of four sons to be born to William and Dorothea Rader. Dorothea,
Kansas.
Let me go. He was baptized at Zion Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and his father was a member of the U.S. Marine Corps, who latter worked for the electricity utility KG&E, starting in 1948. So there you go. That's his parents, anyway. So his family moved to the largest city in Kansas, which is Wichita, when he was a young boy.
Right. Wichita.
It's a cool name, Wichita.
Isn't it? Yeah, I thought that.
Wichita. As a child, Dennis Rader appeared outwardly normal and unremarkable to people. So he's just, you know,
bit of an NPC.
Fucking NPC. He joined the Boy Scouts as a youth and participated in youth church group activities.
Twat.
Yes, eh?
ears. Oh, making little claymation, Daniel and the fucking lions. And fucking knob.
I don't know, Daddy. He attended Riverview Elementary School, where he was an average to mediocre student with withdrawn tendencies.
That's a bad review, isn't it?
Yeah.
Average to mediocre.
Yeah, you could just say average, couldn't you?
Yeah, but they had to put in that like nasty bit, like mediocre.
Oh, God bless him.
Not tapioca. No. Mediocre.
Probably with these being called mediocre. He says he developed fantasies about bondage, control, and torture from an early age while still in grade school. Probably from the teacher who said he was mediocre. As he became sexual, he dreamed of tying girls up and having his way with them. The TV and movie star, Annette Funicello, was one of his favourite targets for imaginary bondage. I think she was on the Mickey Mouse Club. So he was sitting there watching it, and she's like, "Hey guys, MICKYMOUSE. And he's just that fucking imagining a ball gag to fucking knocking one out. This is sorry, isn't it? Fucking teenage Dennis Rader fucking knocking one out with a fucking giving himself an asphyxie wank.
Whilst wearing some fucking mouse ears.
Oh, Mickey Mouse making.
Fucking nutting myself for you.
You're so glad you don't see the hand fucking movements at the moment. Oh, fucking hell. Anyway, he admitted to having killed cats and dogs by hanging them when he was a youth. And he learned to keep his developing inner world of bondage, torture, death a secret from everyone. And did a pretty good job of doing so. Because, as you'll find out, no one suspected Dennis Rader.
No.
So, those guys who knew him personally described him as a quiet and polite young man who preferred to keep to himself. As they always do with the serial killers.
Yeah, yeah.
Hang on, police are coming.
That's an ambulance.
The age of wanking. There you go. The young Dennis showed no interest in music of the times. One friend described him as utterly lacking a sense of humour, but tending to be studious and focused. He was described as a person who chose his words before speaking, and who would give you his full attention as he spoke. But as he did for his entire life, he was the sort of person who appeared outwardly unremarkable and would blend into the background.
All right.
So yeah, total NPC. He graduated from Wichita Heights High School in the class of 63, and in his adolescence he had employment working in a supermarket. It wasn't until 1965 he entered Kansas Wesleyan College in Salina, too far away from Wichita to live at home. Once again, he was a mediocre student with poor grades. And he forced to work in order to support himself. He was constantly busy and even reportedly returned to Wichita on the weekends to continue his supermarket job.
Oh.
Fucking nerd.
Well, they said he was studious. So even though he was really studious, he just wasn't academically talented.
I think he was just like, I can't talk to people at all. So he just fucking pretended to read. But he's just thinking about, like, hog-tying women.
Just like, why is the book upside down? Fuck you, that's why.
My bondage mag isn't. It was also the first time he was able to successfully break and enter into homes and buildings, swiping small items of interest. And he said he found this sort of activity exhilarating.
See, he's good at that.
He's good at that, yeah, but they're not grading that on a curve, are they?
No, no. But you got to be good at something.
Yeah, I suppose. In the summer of 1966, at the age of 21, he joined the US Air Force. He was first sent to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, for basic training. He spent time at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls while doing technical training. In early 1967, he was stationed at Brookley Air Force Base in Mobile, Alabama, and appears to have been there until January 1968, where he was sent to Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa, in the West Pacific.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He appeared to have been based there till the end of his service in 1970, but he did say he spent time in Korea, Greece, and Turkey as well while he was in the Air Force. He's quite well-travelled, isn't he?
Yeah. He's seen a bit of the world.
But guess what? His active duty in the Air Force was pretty unremarkable.
Of course it was.
He attained the rank of sergeant and worked in the installation of antenna equipment, among some other menial tasks. So, by his own description, it was during this period he started having sexual relations with using local prostitutes. But his attempts to engage in bondage activities were rejected. So, he probably tried paying more and they're like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, fair enough.
So he was able to continue his trolling activities from time to time, but his journals make no mention of any incidents where a victim was more than stalked. So he used to just, like, see someone and become fascinated with them and stalk them for ages.
Like that show on Netflix, like You.
Yeah, but not watching him masturbate and then moving to a different part of the country and then masturbating in a back room. Why didn't she just put curtains up?
Yeah.
He could see everything in there. Just, in, you know, if you masturbate with a pillow in front of you, just put curtains up.
Yeah.
God. Glad she's dead. Anyway, he described one incident where he successfully broke into the base library and pilfered a book, but he was never caught.
What book?
It doesn't say. He said he pilfered a book. It was probably something like How to Make Friends and Influence People.
Or The Hobbit.
Yeah, or fucking Mein Kampf, something. I don't think they'd have them on US Air Force bases.
What, Mein Kampf?
Yeah. I don't know, the scientists might have brought them with them.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it might be like, you know, this is how things can go bad. Like, yeah, don't do this.
Don't talk to our friend Hans Smith over there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, he was born in this country, he was just raised in Germany, and he's there with fucking SS tattoos all over him. Operation Paperclip. So Raider received the Air Force Good Conduct Medal, the Small Arms Expert Marksmanship Ribbon, and the National Defence Service Medal, and was discharged from active duty in the summer of 1970 and returned to his hometown of Wichita, Kansas. He would serve 2 more years in the reserves.
You really do relish saying Wichita, don't you?
Wichita. Less than a year after his return to Wichita, on May 22nd, 1971, Dennis Raider and Paula Dietz were married. Paula was also from the same area of Wichita and had attended the same high school, which was, can you remember? Wichita Heights. Yeah. She was also a fellow Lutheran, and Dennis was 26 and Paula was 23 when they got married. It's a nice little story so far.
Yeah, that's lovely.
They settled in Park City, not far from the Raider home in North Wichita, and Dennis was working in the meat department of an IGA supermarket.
Was he a meat packer?
He was, yeah. And Paula was a bookkeeper. It's not as good as Boney, is it?
No, it's not.
Yeah. Aww. In 1972, Raider went to work at the Coleman Company, a manufacturer of camping supplies and Wichita's largest employer at the time. He worked 13 months out until July 1973. Raider then found employment with Cessna, the small aircraft manufacturer. He was also attending Butler County Community College in El Dorado and earned an associate's degree in electronics in 1973.
Nice.
So he's trying to better himself.
Yeah.
In the fall of 1973, though, he began his studies at Wichita State University. It would take him more than 6 years of night school to earn his degree. He was a poor student, a chronic C- or D level, by his own admission.
You'd just stop wasting your time, wouldn't you?
It's good, though, that he isn't, because, you know, he's like, I want to better myself. I'm just shit, but I'll still keep trying.
I'm not a quitter. He wasn't a quitter, this man.
Apparently, he couldn't spell very well and may have had a learning disability reflected in his unusually bad written grammar, according to some teachers. In the late 1973, during the oil embargo crisis, aircraft sales plummeted and he was let go by Cessna. He found himself in a low frame of mind, unemployed, unhappy, with time on his hands. He slipped deeper into the fantasy world and wondered, what would it feel like to strangle somebody to death? I mean, we've all been there.
Yeah, yeah. Specific people, like, as well.
Yeah, I've got a few. I've got a list.
Yeah, me too.
I think we'd probably share the list.
Yeah, I think we would.
Yeah. In January 1974, Dennis Raider was in between jobs and restless. He enjoyed trolling, which consisted of driving or walking around certain neighbourhoods or school campuses where there would be women to observe. He would focus in on a good prospect and enter into his fantasy realm of bondage, torture and death, imagining what he would do to it. Bind them, torture them, kill them were his mantra. These would go on to be known as his projects. So these women call him his projects and he'd give them code names and stuff like that. So we'll get on to that. So pretty shit code names. You ready?
Ready.
So
ready,
the first please. One. There was this new Hispanic family that moved to a corner house at Edgemoor and Murdoch. And one day while dropping his wife Paula off at work, he spied Julie Otero, aged 34, and her daughter Josephine, aged 11. Now, he's got a thing for Hispanic women.
Right, okay.
And apparently he said he admires their beauty and dark hair.
Fair
point. I mean, you know, look at Salma Hayek.
Yeah, she's... Yeah, look at Salma Hayek.
He went on to say that when he saw her, the ball game exploded.
Not the ball gag.
No, I think he probably means he, like, fucking cummed in his pants or something. So anyway, Rader devised a plan. He gathered together a hit kit, as he liked to call them.
Hit kit.
Consisting of a gun, cords, knives, various tools for breaking and entering. Now, he observed the Otero home for a time, getting an idea of when people left or returned, what their daily schedule was like. So he doesn't just go, right, I'm going to go in, and then go in. He sits and watches and plans this out and gets a good time of when they're in, who's leaving, what's the best time.
Smart.
Yeah, so, you know, he puts in the homework for this.
He's just pretending to be an NPC, this man.
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
So, on the morning of January the 15th, he put his plan into effect. After 8 a.m, he came around the house and snuck into the yard and cut the phone line. He went to the back door and spoke to one of the children. He held up a photo and asked if they knew this person, to which the child said no, but his mum might, and then went inside. Then Rader barged in wielding a gun, and his plan was immediately thrown into disarray.
Oh, no.
The man of the house, Joe Otero, who's 38, was still home, as well as Julie, Josephine and Joey, the 9-year-old son. They also had a family dog that started barking at Rader. He was like, oh shit, what have I got to do, what have I got to do? So he ordered Joey to put the dog in the backyard by gunpoint. And then he used the gun to control them and told them he was a wanted criminal who needed money, food and a car to escape. Through all these crimes, he'd always say this. He'd say to some women like, I'm sorry, I've got a sexual problem. I'm just going to rape you and that's it. To sort of kind of put them at ease a bit. Whereas here he'd say like, I want a criminal, I just want money, food and a car and then I'll go. And they're like, okay, so if we go along with you, it'll be there. So at first Joe was dumbfounded and he asked him if this was some sort of joke set up by his brother-in-law. He was like, this big fat white guy's just come in my house with a gun. He's like, is this a joke? Did Donnie put you up to this? And he's like, oh, motherfucker, fucking got a gun. So Rader ordered everyone to lie down in the living room. Then realising that it was too open, he changed his mind and sent them all into the bedroom to be tied up.
Right.
So after tying them all up, he put a bag over Joe's head, but he fought hard and tore holes in the plastic bag. So then Rader used a cord from the Venetian blinds to strangle and kill him. He attempted to manually strangle Julie, but it took considerably longer and much more effort to strangle someone than he thought. So she passed out but then came to a few minutes later. So the second attempt at strangulation did finally kill her. So remember, you've got the two kids here now.
Mm-hmm.
Both parents are dead. 9-year-old Joey was the next one to die. Rader hooded him into his bedroom and he strangled and suffocated him. He apparently rolled off the bed and died face down on the bedroom floor. Rader said he brought a chair into the bedroom and just sat there and watched the boy die.
Fuck.
Yeah. Then 11-year-old Josie was the final one to die. He failed to strangle her again, because he's not learnt that it's hard to actually strangle somebody. He forced her to walk down to the basement. Then he put a noose around her neck and informed her she would be going to heaven to join the others. He asked if she had a camera, but she said they didn't have one. She was hanged from a sewer pipe in the basement and left partially undressed. Rader then masturbated over her bare legs, leaving some semen on the pipe behind her. Afterwards, Rader tidied up a bit, collected his things, and left after a time. He took Joe's watch and a small radio, and he got into their Oldsmobile wagon and drove to the nearby supermarket Dillon's and parked the car. Now, he sort of walked past dead stealthily and just tossed the car keys onto the roof of the supermarket, so no one noticed, and then sort of walked out on foot. Then he walked to his own car, but he then realised, shit, I forgot my knife.
Oh.
So then he got to his own car, he drove back to the Otero house, parked his car in their garage, retrieved the knife from the yard, and then left again. So it didn't give him his trolling that he did. It didn't give him all the information he had on them. He thought, I know everything about this. They had three other older children, all of whom had left for school. And they had Charlie, who was 15, Daniel, who was 14, and Carmen, who was 13. And they were the ones who found their parents dead when they arrived home from school that afternoon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that was his first one. That was kind of a bit of a clusterfuck.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just thought it was going to be her. But, you know, you got the husband, you got kids, fucking barking dog, gets messy. He then fucking loses his knife, has to go back to get the knife and comes back. So it's kind of not as perfect as he wanted it to be.
No, no, he's proper. He's first attempt. It's not great, is it?
No, but you can see his intent of what he's doing there. So in April 1974, he was stalking a woman named Catherine Bright, age 21. He had seen her one day entering a home that she rented in Wichita. He named this project Lights Out. Because her name was Bright. And he's going to kill her. So it's Lights Out for her.
You said they were shit naming.
That is shit.
It isn't. It's brilliant. It's fucking inspired.
Okay, they do get worse. Though. So on April the 4th, he broke into the home via a back porch door. He hid in a bedroom. So he's just like hiding in her bedroom.
Right. Okay. Through a back porch door. Yeah.
Around 2 p.m., she arrived home, accompanied by her brother, Kevin, who was 19 years old. Now, Kevin didn't live there, but he'd gone back with his sister that day because he'd gone to the bank.
Yeah.
Raider startled them by emerging from the bedroom and pointing a gun at them. So he used the same story again, that he's a wanted criminal from California. He's on his way to New York. I need car and money and food and all that bollocks. So he forced the two of them into the bedroom where Catherine was tied up by Kevin. And he was forced at gunpoint to do that. And then he attempted to tie Kevin up in another room. But he hadn't brought his best hit kit with him that day. And he had to improvise for materials found in the home.
Oh.
And Kevin, he worked his way loose and got into a vicious fight with Raider. Nearly succeeding in taking the gun from him. But Raider grabbed the gun back and got off a shot that hit Kevin in the face.
Oh, shit.
Still fighting, Kevin made one more attempt to overpower Raider. But Raider got a second shot in. In the head. Stunned and bleeding, Kevin appeared to be dead or dying. A Raider went back to work on Catherine. Now, she gave him a powerful fight also, but in order to end the scene quickly, Raider switched from attempted strangulation to stabbing, getting her with deep cuts to the abdomen and the surrounding areas. Meanwhile, Kevin had revived and had run out the house for help. So he'd been shot in the side of the face and in the head, and he's got up and running. So fucking Raider was like, holy shit, I gotta get out of there. So he fucking ran from the scene on foot. He ran loads of blocks to where his car was parked and then he drove off. By the time his wife got home from work, he was all cleaned up and nobody suspected a thing. So he has got sort of this thing down of nobody expecting him to go around killing people or anything like that. Catherine died in the hospital a few hours later despite urgent attempts to save her with surgery and blood transfusions. Kevin was left in critical condition with his head wounds, but he survived. He's still living today, Kevin is.
Is he all right? Like, I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
Is he, like, you know, brain damaged or anything?
As far as I know, he's absolutely fine.
What a fucking legend.
I know, yeah. In October of 1974, an editor of the Wichita Eagle newspaper received a phone call directing him to a letter hidden in an engineering book at the Wichita Public Library. So, Dennis Raider, he wanted the attention.
Right.
Okay, so he was like, I want to be like son of Simon Bundy. I want all this attention on me kind of thing. He wrote left a letter and put, I write this letter to you for the sake of the taxpayer as well as your time. Those three dudes you have in custody are just talking to get publicity for the Otero murders. Three people been arrested and they admitted, said, oh yeah, we did the Otero murders. They know nothing at all. I did it by myself and no one help. There has been no talk either. Let's put it straight. So what he did then was list all the murder victims, where they were pointed, what they were killed by, how they were killed, and a few other comments. So like for Joe, he put, southwest bedroom, feet tied to bed, head pointed in a southerly direction. His bondage was window blind cord. Garrot was blind cord in a brown belt. Death, the old bag trick. And strangulation with clothesline rope. The old bag trick.
The old bag trick.
Yeah. And he put there, he threw up one time, had a rib injury from a wreck a few weeks before, and he laid him on a coat because he wanted him comfy. So he put all them down for you. I'm not going to go through it all because he's late. But then the rest of his letter said, all victims had their hands tied behind their backs, gags of pillowcase material, slip knots on Joe and Joseph's neck to hold leg down, or was at one time. I'm not having a stroke. He just can't write properly.
You've just made my brain bleed. Yeah.
Purse contents south of table. Spill drink in that area also. Kids making lunches. Door shade and red chair in living room. Otero's watch missing. I needed one, so I took it. Runs good. Thermostat turned down. Car was dirty inside. Out of gas. I'm sorry this happened to society. Good luck with your hunting. Yours truly, guiltily. P.S. Since sex criminals do not change their M.O. or by nature cannot do so, I will not change mine. The code words for me will be bind them, torture them, kill them. BTK. You see me at it again. They will be on next victim. Yeah.
He's an odd man, isn't he?
He's an odd man to understand, isn't he, by written words?
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, in the fall of 1973, Dennis Rader, who had started working for the ADT security company, he would keep this job for more than a decade, working to install security systems in the very same neighbourhoods he was terrorising.
Right.
After the Oteros and Catherine Bright, Rader would not kill again for almost 3 years. When BTK struck again, his victim was Shirley Vian, a 26-year-old mother of three who was at home with her children.
Right. Fuck.
He told a terrified Shirley that he had a problem with his sexual fantasies and that he needed to tie her up, that if she and her children cooperated, he wouldn't kill them. Shirley complied and helped Rader lock the kids in the bathroom. So he put, like, toys and stuff in there for them.
Keep yourselves busy.
Yeah, he gave him toys and blankets and then tied Shirley's feet to a bedpost. She vomited while he tied her down because, obviously, she's that scared. So he got her a glass of water to try and comfort her. So they sat and had a conversation. Then he secured a plastic bag over her head. And then what he'd do as well is he'd put then a pillowcase over the plastic bag so they couldn't pull out the plastic bag and get air because the pillowcase was over, so they'd still be struggling to do it. So while they did that, he masturbated and he watched her die.
Right.
Her horrified children saw their mother die through an opening in the bathroom door.
Oh, fuck.
Rader was planning to murder the Vian children as well as the Oteros, but then the phone rang and he was scared that the police were on their way and he fled the home, leaving the Vian children locked in the bathroom.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, by the end of 1977, Rader had moved on to yet another project. He called this one Project Fox Hunt. The victim was a 25-year-old woman named Nancy Fox.
Sorry.
You could have called it Project Foxy Lady.
That Fox Hunt works, man. I don't know. That's really... Project Fox Hunt. Fucking Tory.
Anyway, she'd worked for days as a secretary for a construction company, and by night she worked in a jewellery store. Rader stalked her for quite a while. He found out her name, where she worked, even showing up there. He chose December the 8th, 1977, as the day that he would put his plan into motion. He began by parking a few blocks away from Nancy's house. He then walked down the street and knocked on the door. When nobody answered, he went around the back and cut the phone line, then broke in through a kitchen door and waited for her to return home. In his confession, Dennis called this attack the perfect hit. The first attack, everything went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other attack, he had to stab her. Last attack, he's left kids alive. So this one, it was, you know...
Immaculate,
yeah. This is his perfect hit. Rader stated to her that he had a sexual issue and he needed to tie her up and rape her. They talked and smoked cigarettes while he casually went through her purse. She told him to get it over with, but then asked to go to the bathroom first. So she's getting along with it. She's like, okay, you can rape me, just fucking get it over with, then go. He said she could go to the bathroom, but she got to take off all her clothes first. Soon after, she came out of the bathroom naked and he put handcuffs on her and laid her on the bed. He tied her feet and then strangled her with a belt. When she was nearly dead, he released his grip on the belt and whispered in her ear, I am the BTK killer. He said in his confession, this made her squirm even more. However, he just tightened the belt up and didn't let up. He masturbated as she died. He loves a bit of masturbating over people dying, doesn't he?
Yeah, this is a strange dynamic.
I mean, it's his kink, isn't it?
Yeah.
The following morning, after reporting to work at ADT and leaving the office in a company van, he stopped at a phone booth a couple of blocks down the street. He dialed the phone dispatcher and said, yes, you will find a homicide. Homicide.
He's such a pun baron, this guy.
At 843 South Pershing, Nancy Fox, that is correct. And then in true fucking Cordu style, he left the phone hanging.
Yes, you will find a homicide at 843 South Pershing, Nancy Fox.
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand you. What is the address?
843 South Pershing.
police rushed to the residence and found a lifeless body still lying on the bed. A tape recording of that call was eventually played repeatedly over and over in the Wichita media, but no one, including Raider's co-workers or family, were able to recognise his voice. It's probably like, "Hello, here is a homicide. Yes, Nancy Fox, that's correct. I'm a very posh man." I mean, that's what I do if I was disguising my voice. Yeah. "Hello and welcome to Enter the Dark."
"Why are you talking like that? I had a stroke."
In early 1978, Raider attempted to send a postcard with a sarcastic poem, "Shirley Locks," to the Wichita Eagle, but no one recognised the significance of it until days later. He's so bad at this. It's like literally, they're like, "Oh, these people are dying, it's bad. It's the BTK killer. No one cares."
Yeah, like, he just wants to be famous.
It was followed by a letter that was taken quite seriously. In it, the killer took full responsibility for the Otero, Shirley Vianne and Nancy Fox murders, plus an unnamed seventh victim later assumed to be Catherine Bright. So this is his letter he wrote to the newspaper.
Right, okay.
"I find the newspaper not writing about the poem on vain unassuming. A little paragraph would have enough. I nom it not news media fault. The police chief, he keep things quiet and doesn't let the public know they're a psycho running round, loose strangling mostly women. There's seven in the ground. Who will be next? How many do I have to kill before I get a name in the paper or some national attention? Do the cop think that those deaths are not related? Golly gee. Yes, the MO is different in each. But look, a pattern is developing. The victims are tied up. Most have been women. Phone cut. Bring some bondage, mater. Sadist tendencies. No struggle outside death spot. No witnesses except Vane's kids. They were very lucky. A phone call saved them. I was going to take the boys and put a plastic bag over their head like I did Joseph and Shirley. And then hang the girl. God, oh God. God, what a beautiful sexual relief that would have been. Josephine, when I hung her, really turned me on. Her pleading for mercy, then the rope took the hole. She helpless, staring at me with wide terror-filled eyes, the rope getting tighter, tighter. You don't understand these things, because you're not under the influence of Factor X." So he says Factor X is everything serial killers have. "The same thing that made Son of Sam, Jack the Ripper, Harvey Glattman, Boston Strangler, Dr. H.H. Holmes, Pantyhose Strangler of Florida, Hillside Strangler, Ted of the West Coast, and many more infamous character kill. Which cannot seem senseless, but we cannot help it. There is no help, no cure, except death or being caught and put away. It's a terrible nightmare, but you see, I don't lose any sleep over it. After a thing like Fox, I come home and go about life like anyone else. And I will be like that until the urge hit me again. It not continuous, and I don't have a lot of time. It take time to set a kill. One mistake, and it's all over. Since I about blew it on the phone, handwriting is out. Letter guide is too long, and typewriter can be traced too. My short poem with death, and maybe a drawing later, on real picture, and maybe a tape of the sound will come your way. How will you know me? Before a murder or murders, you'll receive a copy of the initial BTK. You keep that copy. The original will show up one day on Guess Who? May you not be the unluck one." Honestly.
I
had to type that out. I was like, let me correct it, but no.
When he's like, you know, I just had this image, like, next on top of the pops. That's where my head went.
And don't worry about this, because there's a PS here. "P.S. How about some name for me? It's time, seven down and many more to go. I like the following. How about you?" Okay, one, you don't pick your own fucking name. Okay. And two, some of these are fucking shit.
Go on. Right,
so one, the BTK Strangler. That's okay. So,
it's all right. You can put that on a t-shirt, can't you? We probably have.
Not yet. The Wichita Strangler.
Meh. Nah.
The Poetic Strangler.
No.
Fucking Poetic Strangler.
No.
He's like, who are you? I am the Poetic Strangler. He's got fucking like scarf flowing in the wind in a beret.
Looks like Edward, Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, he's like,
I am the Poetic Strangler. Quoth the raven, nevermore.
I have come up with a belt to tie, and when I finished, you will die. Fuck off. I just punch him and go, like, fuck off. Go back to a coffee shop, you fucking knob. Poetic Strangler.
Poetic Strangler.
Honestly, Jesus. Okay. Bondage Strangler or Psycho. Is it Bondage? The Bondage Psycho?
No. Bondage Psycho. No. It's just saying what he does and is.
The Wichita Hangman. You've only hung one person.
Yeah.
The Wichita Executioner.
Did he actually spell it like that?
Yeah, Executioner.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
Right, I'm going to leave this one till last because it's my favourite, but... The Asphyxiator, or, I don't know which is worse, Poetic Strangler, or this. The Garrote Phantom. Who are you? I am the Garrote Phantom! You cannot see me! The Garrote Phantom is here, inside your bedroom. Fucking there, wearing like a Phantom of the Opera mask.
With the fucking hat and his cock just laid fucking bare.
He's just, it's fucking, honestly. Why, if you're going to choose anything, like, that dude who's from Britain, the crossbow cannibal.
Yeah.
Didn't kill anyone with a crossbow and he didn't eat anyone. But when he was in court, he's like, I won't be called the crossbow cannibal. And it's like, all right, dude, that's a cool name. Well, you can't just go around going, I want to be the Poetic Strangler. And they're like, have you got any poems? Yeah. Are they good? I think they are. They're not. Spoiler alert for one of his poems. They're not very good. So, the letter forced the Wichita Police Department to make a decision. It was decided that it would be publicly announced that Wichita had an unknown serial killer on the loose. And citizens were urged to be extra careful about locking doors and looking out for each other. Yeah, because they're not going to go... Be careful, the Poetic Strangler is about. Or, be careful, kids, the Garrote Phantom might get you. They're going to be like, fuck off, the Garrote Phantom.
I love how they're just like, no, we're not giving him a nickname. This motherfucker doesn't deserve a nickname.
Yeah, we're not giving you that name, go away. So, a whole generation of women grew up in Wichita that routinely checked their phones for a dial tone whenever they re-entered the home to make sure that the phone line had not been cut. So, imagine that. Like, you're a good woman and you're walking in your house. It's the Garrote Phantom here. No, the phone's still there. That is like the Deadline Diddler or something.
The Deadline Diddler.
I don't know. That's fucking bad. Anyway, in April of 1979, Anna Williams became BTK's next target. Again, he cut a woman's phone line, broke into her house and waited for her return and waited and waited and waited. Anna Williams stayed out late with her friends that evening, and it saved her life. He got tired of waiting and just stole a few things before eventually he left. He's like, oh, can't masturbate to this. I'm out of go. When Anna returned home, she found her house had been broken into and her phone was dead. Bet she fucking shit herself.
I bet you she fucking...
This is a little note. If any of your friends ask you to do things at the last minute, do them. It could save your life.
Yeah.
So, in June, Anna received a package in the mail with a poem entitled, Oh, Anna, why didn't you appear? And a drawing of what Raider is intended to do to her and a few of the things that he's stolen. The next day, a similar package arrived at the studios of Cake TV in Wichita. That's K-A-K-E. Anna was terrified and she moved away from Wichita.
Yeah. Understandable.
So, are you ready for...
Yeah, hit me with this poem.
This is Oh Anna, Why Didn't You Appear? By Dennis Rader. Oh Anna, why didn't you appear? 'Twas perfect plan of deviant pleasure, so bold on that spring night. My inner felling hot with propension of a new awakening season.
What's propension?
Warm and wet with inner fear and rapture, my pleasure of entanglement, like new vines at night. Oh, Anna, why didn't you appear? Drop of fear, fresh spring rain would roll down from your nakedness to to scent to lofty fever that burns within. In that small world of longing, fear, rapture and desperation, the game we play fall on devil ears. Fantasy spring forth, mounts to storm fury, then winter clam at the end. Oh, Anna, why didn't you appear? Alone now in another time span, I lay with sweet enrapture, garments across the most private thought. Bed of spring, moist grass, clean before the sun, enslaved with control. Warm wind scenting the air, sunlight sparkle tears in eyes, so deep and clear. Alone again I trod in past memory of mirrors and ponder why for number 8 was not. Oh, Anna, why didn't you appear? So yeah, he's not a very good poet, is he?
No.
That's like, they probably passed that to some fucking 8-year-old kids the FBI did and were like, analyse that poem. And like, he's feeling winter in there. It's fucking terrible.
It's horrible. It is very horrible. Like,
and that is why you are not the poetic strangler. It's fucking horrible.
It's not Wordsworth, is it?
So then, so that was 1979, okay? Fast forward now to 1985.
Okay.
Okay. So as far as anyone knows, it's been a number of years since The Last Kill. Raider was a busy family man and a person with no criminal record, and he was apparently religious and he was helpful at his church.
Oh, okay.
Fucking Lutherans. Despite all this, he took a great risk to pull off his next murder. Marion Hedge lived 5 houses away from Dennis Raider. She was a petite woman recently widowed who he'd wave at when he saw her outside gardening. In the April of 1985, he decided she would be the ideal project for him. So he dubbed her Project Cookie.
That one's shit.
It's because sometimes she'd bake cookies and he could smell them. Project Cookie. Not Project Hedge Fund or Project Trim the Hedge.
Project Cookie.
Yeah.
This man has the mind of a fucking child.
You say that, but this is pretty badass. So the weekend of April 27th, 1985, he was attending a Boy Scout camp out just outside of Wichita. He left camp in the evening, saying he had a headache and needed to go into town and buy something for it. He parked his car by a bowling alley in the city and brought himself a beer. He swished the liquid in his mouth and then spat it out and got some on his clothes so he'd smell like he'd been drinking.
Uh-huh.
He called a cab, pretended he was drunk, and instructed the driver to take him to a park in Park City so he could walk it off before home. The park adjoined the backyard of the Hedge property. Raider was disappointed to see Marine's car in the carport. He assumed she was home, so he's like, shit. He cut the phone line and quietly pried open a rear door using a screwdriver. It turned out that no one was home, so he was like, yes. And after a while, a car pulled up and Raider hid in a bedroom closet. So Marine Hedge and a male friend entered the home. The man left for the night around 1 a.m. and Raider was in her wardrobe. He waited while she had a shower, she went to bed, she fell asleep. He then crept out of the closet, flicked on the bathroom light and pounced on Marine in bed, manually choking the 100-pound woman to death. However, his fantasy-driven outing was far from over. He dragged the body with her bedding to her car and put her in the trunk. He drove directly to his church, where he was a person so trusted he had keys to it. He dragged the body underneath some trees and then entered the building down to the basement, where he taped black plastic over the basement window so no one could see inside. He then dragged the body down into the basement and photographed it in various poses. So it's getting late now, so he hurriedly returned the body to the car trunk and took off. He found a dumping place in a ditch along a dirt road and several miles outside of Park City, and he semi-concealed the body under some trimmings. He left knotty pantyhose by the body, which apparently had been used for some purpose during that night. And at one point, Raber had dropped the car key onto the dashboard and the key slid down and wedged under the windshield. He used a rock to smash a corner of the windshield to retrieve the key. He's so bad at this. So he said he's got a headache and he's just going to get something. So he said to another scout leader, oh yeah, I'll be back soon. I've got a headache. It's starting to get light now, so he hurriedly made his way back to where he'd left his car. He parked Marine's car there, wiped it down for fingerprints, and returned to the scout camp he'd deserted earlier. He was never connected to this crime until 20 years later.
Whoa.
And the only reason was he still had those photographs in his collection. In September 1986, Raider had his eye on Vicky Wegley, a 28-year-old mother of two. He would walk by her house hearing strains of piano music Vicky played. So he dubbed her Project Piano. I would have called it Project Tinkling the Ivories or something. It'd be a bit better, wouldn't it? Yeah, that's much better, man. So, on September the 16th, he took some time out for his murder project. He showed up sometime after 10 a.m. and he showed up at Vicky's drawer dressed as a telephone repairman, complete with a hard hat. So he's got like the full cosplay going on. He somehow managed to get Vicky to allow him inside her home to check the phone. He fiddled with the phone and improvised testing gadget and then informed her she was going to be tied up. He got a gun out, he forced it into the bedroom and attempted to tie her up, but she started fighting back and scratching him in the process. Raider prevailed in the physical fight and secured her with ropes and then proceeded to strangle her to death using pantyhose as a ligature.
Ah.
He photographed the dying body in a few poses and then hastily left in the waggly car. Vicky had warned him that her husband would be arriving home shortly, and he later stated that had the husband come home, he would like to kill him too. Now, her husband, Bill Wegley, indeed came home soon afterwards, so soon that he saw his own car going in the opposite direction away from his house. So he couldn't identify the driver, but he was like, that's not Vicky. That man is my wife. And when he got there, his two-year-old son, Brandon, was still in the living room unattended.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so he'd killed her and everything while his son's just sitting there. So Bill couldn't find Vicky at first, who was on the bedroom floor behind the bed, but finally did after a while. She was rushed to a hospital with paramedics desperately trying to revive her, but she was pronounced dead a short time later. BTK, meanwhile, had driven around the city for a while, disposing of evidence, and then returned to the area near the house and parked the Wegley's car a couple of blocks from their home.
Mm-hmm.
He exited the area on foot and returned to his own car nearby. Changing clothes, he escaped all detection for this crime, and he was never, ever, ever suspected of it. Now, Bill Wegley, his life took a horrible turn. He'd not only lost his wife and mother of his two children, he was faced with a hostile and sceptical police and public who never seemed satisfied that he was innocent of this crime. So this dark cloud hung over him for the next 18 years.
And yeah, it's not always the husband.
Yeah, nobody had heard from BTK in 8 years, and the police were like, this isn't a BTK crime. He's not around anymore. So no charges were ever filed against him, but everyone was like, you killed your wife. We know you'd. If we could get the evidence, we would get there. So, in 1988, Raider succeeded in getting himself fired from ADT Security. The official reason stated by the company was that he was not getting his work quota done. The varying reports from co-workers described the man as who could be difficult to work with, but he was very customer-orientated. One description of him from that time paints a picture of a man who wanted to be a police officer, but had been forced to settle for what Raider saw as inferior position of being an alarm installer.
Right.
But in any case, then he's out of a steady job. He's 45 years old now, and he's getting wary of younger women, because he's like, they're going to fight back or they're going to have a male present. So he saw older women as more vulnerable. So he started to focus his attention on an older woman who lived alone. She was 62 years old and called Dolores Davis. She only lived about a mile and a half from where he did, but there was no indication he was personally acquainted with her at all. She had moved to Park City area after years as an executive secretary in Wichita and was renting a house in the area without close neighbours. She lived near a dog kennel.
Let me guess.
So she became Project...
Dog Kennel.
Almost. Project Dogside. I don't know. He masturbates on dead bodies.
I'd have called it Project Geriatric.
I would have called it Project Double D. Dolores Davis. Anyway, this will be another well-planned project. Using the pretext of being away for the weekend on a scouting camp outing in Harvey County, which was just to the north of Sedgwick County where he resided, he again invented an excuse to slip away from the camp in the evening. Now, this was a fucking freezing cold night. Okay, it was below freezing and everything. He first drove his car to nearby his church where, because he was a scout leader, he had the keys again. So he's like, oh, I could go in there. Went inside, changed into dark clothes, and assembled his hit kit of ropes, bindings, and weapons. I love how he leaves a hit kit stuff in the church.
Yeah.
Then he walked 2 miles in the bitter cold to Dee's house. When he got there, Dolores was still awake, reading in a bed. He waited out in the cold for a light to turn off and go to sleep, using a cement block taken from a shed in the backyard. He ran through the sliding glass door at the rear of the house.
Subtle.
Yeah, before he's like, oh, slowly pry it. Now he's just like, fuck this. She came out of the bedroom thinking someone had driven into her house. So he went to her. I'm a vagrant. I need food, money and a car. And I'm going to have to tie you up. So she was like, oh, okay. So he tied her up in the bedroom. Nobody knows how long he was there for. But Dolores helped ruin his fun by telling him that she was expecting someone to arrive any minute. So he ended her life by ligature strangulation.
Didn't he get knock one out?
Raider dragged the body outside and put it in the trunk of her car. He drove a short distance to a lake near the I-135 by Park City and left the body and other evidence there under some trees. He then drove the car back to the Davis house and wiped it down for fingerprints, tossing the keys onto the roof. Raider then set out on foot, walking in a roundabout fashion back to the Baptist church. Driving his own car, he returned to where he left the body and put it in his car. He meandered around to the north and settled on a remote spot underneath a bridge in northern Sedgwick County as a dumping spot. After leaving her there, he went somewhere to change back into his scout uniform and return to the camp. The following night, he left camp again to come back to the dumping spot to pose and photograph the body, and he placed a mask on her to beauty her up. Now, he's got this fucking freaky woman mask that he wears, like, because he'd give himself an asphyxie wank, like, hang himself from a toilet. Nah, and he'd wear that. And have you ever seen the film Alice, Sweet Alice?
No.
Yeah, wears a mask, looks like that. It's fucking freaky.
Is there photos of this?
Yes.
We're going to put them in?
Yeah, of course I am. Yeah. Look at you fucking asking here. Soon after the murder, Raider took a photo of himself buried in a grave. He said he had dug for Dolores Davis, and he was wearing a mask and using a Polaroid camera activated with a mechanism triggered via cord. So he's made this thing so he can lie there all fucking bondaged up, like click a button, so that, it takes photos of him.
That's like the first fucking selfie ever.
It is, isn't it?
Wow.
Of him, bondaged up, wearing a mask. Only 4 months after this episode, Raider was hired by Park City as compliance and animal control officer. So he became a combination of fucking a dog catcher and a local code enforcer. In his mind, he's like, oh, I'm part of law enforcement. And he was fucking really overzealous with this. He was like fucking really petty with it. He'd write citations if a lawn exceeded 6 inches in grass height. There were complaints against him and several people moved away from Park City due to his mistreatment. There was this one woman who's got this dog, right?
Yeah.
And no case went against him except for this one. So a woman contested a $25 fine levied against her by Raider over her dog control. So he showed up in court with a satchel a half inch thick full of official documents and won the case, right? And another woman had a disturbing story about him. There was no problem with it until she got divorced and a new male friend came to live with her. So he used to go around giving his citation for it, things like, your garden hose is the wrong colour. And he'd be like, your car's parking 4 inches too far out. And all this stuff. And he didn't like the inoperable vehicle in the driveway the male friend was working on, and made it clear to the woman, if the man left, he'd leave her alone.
Jesus Christ.
So he started looking in the windows one day and was found to be examining a door that had been mysteriously broken. But it all culminated when he impounded her daughter's dog and had it put to sleep before anyone could reclaim it.
Fuck.
So she immediately fucking left Park City.
Yeah.
Also, in a gender discrimination lawsuit filed in federal court. So during the 1990s, he served on two local boards in Park City as well.
This guy just sounds like the worst fucking Jobsworth.
He's
one of them, isn't he? Is there a male version of a Karen?
Yeah, Dennis.
Yeah, because that's... He's a proper Dennis, isn't he? That's a new one now, fucking Dennis.
Yeah.
Get memeing it, folks.
So, in 2003, Raider was elected to the church council and assumed the position of vice president, starting on January the 1st, 2004. So, he remained quite active in their Lutheran church, and Dennis was apparently a trusted leader, helper, and usher.
So what does a church president do?
I don't know. Not much.
They don't give mass, do they?
No, just... he'll be like organising fucking fairs and stuff like that.
Sending the collection.
Yeah, and organising food drives and shit like that. Yeah. It's fucking a title.
Yeah.
So, anyway, despite all this, his kids have gone and he found himself increasingly bored. So he's got this job, he's doing all this shit, he's bored. So the Online Crime Library had just published an article about the unsolved BTK cases. It was thought BTK was dead, jailed, or institutionalised, perhaps. The subject had faded even in Wichita, and loads of the kids who were growing up now didn't have much knowledge of the case. And Rader had thought about publicly re-emerging later on in life, but then all of a sudden, BTK became a topic of interest again. So he's like, maybe when I'm older, I'll come back.
I'll put the mask back on.
He's like, you know, I'll get the band back together. So a Wichita lawyer named Robert Beattie was concerned that the BTK case was being all but forgotten. He set out to write a book about the investigation that tried so hard to capture this elusive killer, who he still reasoned to be a potential threat to the public, even though the last known murder occurred in 1977.
Right.
BTK was attributed with 7 murders and the attempt on Anna Williams in 1979. Beattie was responsible for renewed interest in the BTK case as early as 2003. And the message board on crime and justice began discussing the case again on the internet. So, January 2004 was the 30th anniversary of the Otero murders, and the Wichita Eagle ran an article about the crime and the BTK killer. In conjunction with that came the announcement of the new book. So, fucking Dennis Rader's like, whoa, 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 whoa. What's going on here? Someone else is telling my story. He's like, this is fucking bollocks, right? He's like, right, do you know what? I'm back. On March the 17th, he mailed an envelope to the Wichita Eagle from a Bill Thomas Kilman, BTK.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a clever one.
It contained 3 photocopied pictures of his own photos of the dying Vicky Waggerly taken in 1986, as well as a photocopy of her missing driver's license. He signed it with the BTK symbol he had used in his previous letters in the 1970s. As soon as the story hit the media, BTK was back in the spotlight like never before, because this time you had the added dimension of internet and discussion boards, chat rooms and websites sprouted up dedicated to the unsolved mystery of the BTK case.
Did the symbol look good that he did?
I'll show you in a bit. It's all right. The dust hadn't begun to settle when Rader sent a second letter, this time to May 5th, 2004, to the studios of Cake TV, the Wichita ABC affiliate. This was a lengthy word puzzle consisting of columns of letters with a few numbers mixed in. The FBI verified that this also came from BTK, as he characteristically used his unique signature, but couldn't make any particular sense out of the puzzle. Probably because he spelt all the fucking words wrong himself.
Like this is...
On June the 9th, 2004, Rader left a package taped to a stop sign at the corner of First in Kansas, in the middle of the city. This contained a disturbing collection of documents, including a letter detailing the grisly murders of the Otero family and a sketch of a nude and bound female hanging by a rope. 11-year-old Josephine Otero had been hanged by a rope in the basement of their home in 1974. The sketch was labelled, "The Sexual Thrill Is My Bill." For fuck's sake. It also includes was a chapter list entitled The BTK Story that mimicked the chapter list of David Lowe's original article on BTK on the Online Crime Library. Chapter 1 was entitled A Serial Killer Is Born. Fucking this guy.
He's
such a fucking nerd. On July the 17th, 2004, a package marked BTK was found in a boot return at the Wichita Public Library downtown. It contained a message... I have spotted a female that I think lives alone and/or is a spotted latchkey kid.
Latchkey.
Just got to work out the details. I'm much older, not feeble.
And have to
conditions myself carefully. Also, my thinking process is not as sharp as it uses to be.
For fuck's sake.
I think Four All Winter would be just about right for the hit. Got to do it this year or next. Time is running out for me. It's like, my thinking's not a show. And they're like, fucking hell. Where are you then? Some sort of fucking in comatose state? The same package contained an intriguing claim that he, the BTK, had engineered the recent death of a 19-year-old man from Argonia, Kansas, named Jake Allen. So apparently he committed suicide by laying on railroad tracks 12 days earlier. But there's no proof of this at all, and he didn't admit to it after or anything so. Despite the huge pressure from the public, the police refused to release many details from the packages from June, as it was feared that hearing these things would provoke BTK into a killing frenzy. The fifth drop didn't occur until October the 22nd, 2004, when a UPS worker found a strange manila envelope while picking up the contents of the UPS box at the Omni Center by Second in Kansas in Wichita. This consisted of a very disturbing assortment of cards that had been pasted on them. There was a collage of pictures of children with bindings drawn across their bodies and faces. This envelope also contained what BTK claimed to be his autobiography, listing a number of details about his life, such as being born in 1939, his father dying in the war, mother dated a railroad detective, and so on. None of that happens. My mother dated a railroad detective. BTK claimed to be fascinated with railroads and usually lived near railroad tracks. Fucking idiot. Almost all of it was false information, an attempt to lead police into researching false clues. The police did release the autobiography to the public a few weeks later, was greatly pleased, if not excited, Dennis Rader. So he's there like, oh, here's my autobiography. And he's like, it's all a lie, Dennis.
You're telling fibs.
Fucking hell, Dennis. Lies make baby Jesus cry, even if you're a Lutheran. What the Wichita Police Department was actually doing was follow the FBI's advice. Keep in communicating. Using lead detective Lieutenant Ken Sandweir as the sole media spokesperson, the strategy was to establish a sort of familiarity between the criminal and the media person so that BTK would begin to feel as though Landwehr was talking to him directly in a personal sort of way. The idea was not to offend him nor overexcite him into killing more, just keep him talking until he makes a mistake. It was a plan that read directly into solving the case. So, on December 1st, 2004, officers of the Wichita Police State stormed the house of Roger Valadez, who lived in a house in Wichita with peeling paint within sight of railroad tracks. He was held on a minor outstanding warrant, but apparently was suspected of being BTK. But the DNA test quickly exonerated him. Because remember, they've got his semen.
Yeah. He's left that in a few places, hasn't he?
Ultimately, police would take some 1,300 DNA swabs of men searching for a match to BTK's semen left at crime scenes. Raider's sixth drop was found on December 14, 2004. A man walking through the Murdoch Park that night noticed a package wrapped in white plastic leaning against a tree. Out of curiosity, he took it home with him and opened it. He's like, oh, it's drugs. It contained a PJ doll. The doll's head had a plastic bag tied over it. Its hands were tied behind its back and its feet were bound together. Tied to the feet was a real driver's license belonging to the BTK murder victim Nancy Fox, whom he killed in December 1977. The family notified Cake TV, who arrived to photograph the contents and then notified the police. Cake agreed not to broadcast what they found in the package for fear of arousing the killer, because that's going to get him off.
Yeah.
And January 1st, 2005, he officially became the new president of the church council at Christ Lutheran Church in Wichita. Well done, Dennis.
Nice. Aspirational man.
8 days into a new year, Dennis Rader left a special case cereal box marked BTK and Bomb in the bed of a pickup truck at the Home Depot of North Woodlawn. The truck belonged to an employee of Home Depot. He thought it was trash at first and put it in a trash can at home. Luckily, he forgot to put the trash can out for the collection. On January 25th, when police arrived at Home Depot looking for clues in the BTK case, having been tipped off from a postcard from BTK, the man was like, oh, hang on. I thought it was a child's craft project. Here you go. I've got it. By reviewing surveillance tape of the parking lot on January the 8th, they got their first glimpse of BTK, but the images were too blurry for identification. but by measuring the wheelbase of the black vehicle he was driving, it was determined the vehicle was a Jeep Cherokee. Despite having installed alarm systems for a living, Raider was apparently unaware that surveillance cameras were a commonplace item.
Oh, for fuck's sake! This guy.
The box itself contained some information about his projects, his intended victims that he watched or stalked, and more misleading information about how he lived in a three-story home in Wichita that had an elevator that had a bomb in the basement. He also asked about particular questions to detectives. He said, "If I put my writing on a computer disk, would it be traceable?" He requested a response to be posted in the Wichita Eagle classified ads in the miscellaneous section using his code name, Rex.
Rex.
The eighth drop was another cereal box from the serial killer. This was a Post Toasties. It was discovered on January 25th, 2005, and as a result of a tip from Drop 9, which was a postcard sent to Cake TV with a return address of S. Killett. Skillett.
Yep.
Plus the address of the Otero house.
Right.
The 10th drop was another postcard that arrived on February the 3rd, again sent to Cake. Return address was Hap Cakeman, a 1950s character from Cake's past. Raider wrote, "Thank you for your quick response on 7 and 8. Thanks to the news team for their efforts. Sorry about Susan and Jeff's colds. Business issues. Tell WPD that I received newspaper. Tip for a go. Test run soon. Thanks. P.S. May want to use KTV/PC-ETC code #. And letters from me to my verification code to you." So he's referring there to a newspaper ad where the detectives would answer him about his computer disk. He said, "Rex, it will be okay." So he's like, "Okay then, here's a floppy disk which is totally untraceable." It's such a fucking boomer.
Yes, isn't he?
Like, fucking installed things, but then, no, I don't know about surveillance cameras or the fucking floppy disk can be traced. So, the Drop 11 arrived at the studios of KSAS TV on February 16th, the Fox affiliate in Wichita. It contained a letter, a piece of jewellery, and a purple diskette referred to as Test Floppy for WPD review.
Right.
Detectives wasted little time in analysing the diskette and found software on it from the Christ Lutheran Church in Wichita and the name Dennis. So he thought he'd erased it, but they just used the metadata on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh yeah, we found this. So a quick internet search brought up a website for the church mentioning the current president, Dennis Raider. A group of detectives quietly drove by Raider's house in Park City and noted the black Jeep Cherokee parked in the driveway. He was placed under surveillance while a subpoena was secretly obtained for a DNA sample of his daughter's from a medical record.
Right.
They tested the DNA from a pap smear Raider's daughter had taken while she was a student at Kansas State University, and her DNA was revealed that she was a close match to the killer. So after leaving the office to eat lunch at home, as was his custom, on February 25th, 2005, Raider was driving home when he noticed he was totally surrounded by police. I imagine it's going to be like fucking Goodfellas, where he's like concentrating, thinking there's a helicopter, and he pulls out and the fucking gun against his head and the police are all in his street.
Yeah, yeah.
So he surrendered quietly and led to a waiting police car to be handcuffed. "Hello, Mr. Landwehr," he said once inside the car. "Hello, Mr. Raider," Lieutenant Colonel Landwehr responded to him. So at first, he got to the police that he wouldn't talk about the crimes and he was just avoiding the subject. But when they said to him, "Look, you know that computer disk? Yeah, we lied, we traced it, we know it's you." He was like, "Okay then." He talked for 30 hours.
30 hours.
Endlessly rambling about his crimes and reciting his achievements. So never before known details of his crimes, his methods, his mind, all came to light. Many excerpts of what can be of the interview can be read in a 92-page PDF document of state summary of the evidence.
Did you read this?
I didn't read all of it because I can't be arsed, but I will leave a link to it for you. Dennis Raider's trial on the 10 counts of first-degree murder was set for June 27, 2005. As the date approached, there was no news of a postponement, and speculation erupted about what Raider was up to.
Right.
So it became apparent that he was used the appearance to formally plead guilty, and he did so. But then it turned into a dramatic courtroom in confession as Judge Waller began to quiz Raider over some of the details of the crime. Before the millions of viewers watching live coverage in the Kansas local stations and on court TV nationally and all around the world on the internet, he calmly revealed some of the grisly details of his murders from his own perspective, talking about strangulations, hit kits, ruses, projects, just like it was an everyday thing.
Yeah.
On July 26, 2005, his wife Paula filed for an emergency divorce, citing physical and mental distress. And they were just like, yeah, you can have that divorce.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is the thing, his family didn't suspect him.
Yeah.
Like, his daughter in her book, she said, like, there was no way I thought my dad, like, no one even suspected. He was like, he had to give up ownership rights on the small house he shared with his wife, as well as all the other belongings that they owned. She could benefit from a 2 pension fund that he had established as well, so she could claim his pensions. They did put their family home up for auction. It was appraised at $57,000, but someone bid $90,000 to say, you know, you can get on with your life. But the legal disputes with the victims' families were like, you're fucking profiteering off this. The deal didn't go ahead. And on August the 18th, Judge Waller sentenced Dennis Rader to the maximum sentence permitted by law, a minimum of 175 years to life in prison. He will be eligible for parole in 2180. So I don't think he's going to make it that far.
No, no, no.
But yeah, that is the BTK killer. Now, in a way, if the BTK killer had not been caught, we'd be like, who is he? No, I think he's dead. Or he's in prison and stuff. You wouldn't be like, he's fucking president of the Lutheran Church. And also a fucking boomer who doesn't know how floppy disks and metadata work. What he did, how he stalked them, he broke in, all that stuff, it's quite impressive.
It's quite tactical.
But you could just tell how he wanted the attention more than anything.
Yeah.
He was like, no, fucking give me attention. I want this, I want that. You haven't given me a nickname. How about the Garot Phantom?
He comes off as somebody whose like enthusiasm far outweighs his ability.
Yeah, and everyone was like, he's just a normal guy, you know.
That's not normal.
Bit intense. I think I read a story somewhere that one time his wife come home and found him doing it the old asphyxie wank.
Like Kill Bill, man.
Yeah, and they were like, what's going on? And she was like, oh, you know, don't worry, Jesus will help you. And he's like, yeah. And then he said he was sorry and they stayed together. But I don't know if that was true or not. But I read that somewhere.
What a bitch that she come in while he was doing
yeah,
that.
You know, she'd come home and like the door was knocking. And she was like, what the fuck's going on? And he's like hanging himself from the door with his woman mask on, doing the old asphyxie wank, doing the old Michael Hutchence.
I don't know. I think that would sort of put a dampener on things, wouldn't it? Like, this is what you're into.
Yeah.
It's like, I could have dealt with you wanting pegging, but this, like...
All you have to do there is just go, this happened in childhood. And then your wife's going to be like, I'm so sorry, you know. I'm going to ask God for forgiveness. Bollocks. That's what they can say.
Do you know?
What? Do I know what?
Just like... It's okay, you like it.
No, I'm just saying that's what he'd be like, wouldn't he? If he's a big Christian guy, he's going to be like, I can ask God for forgiveness. And his wife's like, okay, you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do I know? No, I don't know the BTK. We can write to him, though, if you want to.
I mean, yeah,
why he sends not? You fucking shit poems, though, apparently.
Does he? Get in. Can we do this? Can we, like, sort of just get a thing going? Is he on email?
No, he's in prison.
Yeah, but he's still surely got access to things.
We'll find his address and we'll write to him.
Okay.
Ask him for a poem. Say we really liked his poetry. Lie, basically. And then get a poem and then we can read it out. Ask him and title it Enter the Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. Anyway, guys. So, yes, that was BTK. What do you guys think? Do you think he was a cold-hearted, calculating killer or just a fucking bit of a nerd? It's up to you. Once again, thank you for joining us. Thank you for supporting us by hitting subscribe and also the notification bell. If it is your first time, welcome. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to us. You can get in touch with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and email at enterthedarkpodcast@gmail.com. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/enterthedark. Also, the links in there for t-shirts and all that kind of good stuff. Once again, thank you to all our patrons who support us on Patreon. We think you're awesome, and we know you don't have to do it, but you do, and it makes us feel nice, and we don't usually feel nice. We usually feel ashamed of what we do.
Yeah, alone. Especially the door thing.
Yeah.
It's okay, Jan, it's okay.
The old asphyxie wanks, we can do it. If I ever do die like that, though, if I'm ever doing an asphyxie wank and you find me, just undo me, right? Put me in normal clothes. Yeah. Right? Take the apple out of my mouth. Just put me in there and just say, I don't know what happened. Okay? I'll do the same for you.
Thanks. Thanks, Pam.
That's friendship.
That is.
So then, guys, thank you for joining us today. I've been Jan. This is Les. We are the Asphyxie Wank Twins. We shall see you soon.